Welcome to the Time and Motion podcast with me, your host, Lee Stevens. For over 25 years, I've worked with businesses all over the world to improve the technology and the people within them. In this podcast, I share some of my experiences and I chat to guests who generously share their stories of how to, or in some cases, how not to, live a productive life. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to Time and Motion with me, Lee Stevens. So before I introduce today's guest, I just wanted to ask a quick request. That request is to give me some honest feedback. Now, the best way to do that is by rating the show, whether that be on Spotify or Apple, which is the main two platforms which I can see that everyone uses. So to do that on Spotify, you need to go to the show, you need to click the three dots, and then it'll be rate show. So you just need to click on that and then give the show a rating. To do that on Apple or on podcasts, what you need to do is just need to go to the show and then you need to scroll right down past all the recent episodes and there you'll see ratings and reviews. So if you can give that a 5-star rating or whatever rating you feel it's worth with some comments, that would be really helpful and it will help me improve the content, the guests and the way we run the show. This week, I catch up with Michelle Chen, who is an immigration lawyer and an employment law specialist based here in New Zealand. Michelle's family moved over from China in the 80s and opened up a restaurant. Michelle worked in that restaurant when she was younger, and during that time, it really spurned a passion for her about how to help people and how to help businesses employ immigrant workers from overseas to improve their productivity and just generally improve their businesses. Really fascinating episode. And if you're like me, was always interested in what options were available for both employers and for the people themselves, worth a listen. So on with the show. Michelle Chen from MC Legal. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lee.
How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, it's not as wet as it has been in Christchurch the last few days, but still quite brisk out there, right?
Yeah, sort of like typical Cantabrian winter, really. We get crisp in the morning and then hopefully nice weather in the afternoon.
Yeah, fingers crossed, fingers crossed. Okay, so before we kind of get into all the good stuff, just tell us who you are and what MC Legal does.
Yes, so my name is Michelle Chen. I'm an immigration lawyer. I've set up my own practice called MC Legal, and my business aims at providing specialist immigration advice to businesses and to individuals. The reason why I set this up, it's less than 12 months, so about 7 to 8 months in. The reason why I set it up was just to be able to make a difference through my immigration knowledge. So, yeah.
So immigration law and questions is something that I guess I've always been asked about in the industries that I've worked in, obviously quite complementary to what you do. So I thought it'd be really good to get you on the show and actually be able to dispel some of those myths and answer some of those common questions that business owners and business executives in New Zealand especially have. So it'll be a bit of a grilling. So hopefully not anything courtroom style that you might be used to in your training. Okay, so before we kind of get into things really, let's just talk a bit about you. Let's go back. So where did you grow up and what was early life like for you?
So I was born in New Zealand, so you can hear it from my accent, but visually I'm Chinese. so I grew up in Taranaki. I was born in Whanganui, spent about 9 to 10 years in Hauwera, which is a tiny town about an hour to an hour and a half away from Whanganui, or about an hour and a half from New Plymouth in the North Island. And yeah, I grew up helping my parents out at their restaurant. So my parents are first generation migrants. So they came over from southern China, from a small village in Guangzhou, just outside of the city, in the mid 80s. And then they came over as skilled migrants. So that's the reason why I got into the sort of the immigration laws that's always resonated quite closely to me as well. And yeah, so I grew up helping them out in their restaurant and then later fish and chip and then back to restaurants again, all throughout New Zealand, really. So they had businesses in Hauwera, Napier, Auckland, Hamilton and Waiuru, which is where the army base is. Yeah, so I've kind of grown up in that central North Island aspect and yeah.
And did your family have businesses back in China?
No. So my dad's quite interesting. So he initially worked in construction. So that was sort of because they lived in the village, it was really them needing to upskill. My dad went into the city, did a little bit of labouring, and then I think he got his chef or culinary certificate in Guangzhou City, working at some restaurants. But my grandfather, from my mum's side, he was a businessman, and he would go between mainland China and Hong Kong at the time. Yeah, so I've sort of got that sort of business background-ish, yeah.
Fantastic. And what was early life like for you growing up?
It was good. Like in Harbour, it was really great because it was, at the time, I think it's my naivety and ignorance, but I always felt really safe. So I would just go on a bike ride. I was 5 years old and would just zoom across the town because it was so small. And then I would always help out at mum and dad's restaurant, like I mentioned earlier. So they've sort of instilled into me hard work and putting in the hard yards. So I remember finishing school and then, not because I was forced to or anything, you know, all those labour laws, but because I wanted to help them out. And, you know, saw them, they were really struggling. But, I remember learning the menu. There was like 100 items on the restaurant menu. I remembered every single item and the price of each. And then it was, and then I was only five or six years old. So, yeah, so it was quite good. And then talking in English at school was interesting, and then Chinese at home. I remember growing up being a little bit confused sometimes. I start talking to some friends in Chinese or Cantonese, and yeah, no, it was good.
Growing up in multicultural London like I did in the 80s, I had some friends who probably very similar to you in their background, where they used to help their family out in their restaurants or their businesses. But it was amazing how, yeah, I suppose so much social skills and people skills they were learning very quickly. They probably didn't realise at the time. They just thought, oh, you know, mum and dad are making me work again. But yeah, just the nature of people and customer service and, you know, all that good stuff that you, and product and marketing and all that kind of good stuff. You probably you take it for granted, I'm guessing, at that age, right? But yeah, in years later, you probably realise it put you in good stead for what you do now.
Yeah, it was actually quite interesting because I remember when I was about 15, I started to negotiate my wages with mum and dad because I didn't get paid, obviously. So, so I remember saying to mum, oh, you know, mum, I think the minimum wage is, I don't know, I can't remember how much it was at the time. I said, oh, but, you know, I'm willing to work for half of that if you give me a pocket allowance. And she's like, hang on a second, you've been working for free and now you want wages. What's this?
Maybe that's where the nucleus of the fairness kind of started, right? You know, I want what's right.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So where did you go to university?
So initially I started out at Otago. So I went down after high school, moved out of home. So my parents at the time was in Auckland, and I never ever wanted to go to Auckland Uni, which is funny because it's great university, but I just wanted to get out. So Dunedin, started a Bachelor of Science majoring in neuroscience, was two papers from finishing, realised that I wasn't smart enough to be a doctor, and I didn't want to work in a lab all day every day because I like that people interaction. So then I decided to do law. And I wanted to move a bit closer to home because at that stage it was about 2.5 years in cold Dunedin. So I decided to move up to North Island and did my law degree at Waikato University. And I did that in, I think, 2.5 years because I was able to do all law papers instead of just, you know, the combination of the two. Yeah.
So graduated with a law degree.
Mm-hmm.
Did you then go and work in one of the big lawyers, big legal firms?
No, I didn't actually. I never applied. In my last year, I spent a month abroad in Shanghai. So that's where I did business law and intellectual property not in Chinese. My Mandarin wasn't good at all at that stage. And I did a 6-month language course there. Came back, graduated, did profs, which is that professional studies program that you have to do to be able to get admitted to the bar. Decided to do a stint in Australia. So my partner and I moved over to Brisbane. We gave ourselves up to 6 months because of our student loan. We didn't want interest to incur on it. I couldn't actually get a job over there. And so what I did was I just worked part-time at Michael Hill. selling diamonds. So that was fun. And then in my first 3 months of training, just, you know, as a sales, and it was only part-time, I became the top salesperson for Queensland 2 weeks in a row. So that was quite funny. And that was the first time anyone that had been in the first 3 months of training had ever done that. So
yeah. So I was quite fortunate to work with a number of legal firms in my consulting business that I exited in December. And one thing that always struck out to me was how competitive those grad and those intern roles are. And like, it's, you know, one firm mentioned to me, they get 300 applicants every year for 10 positions, right? So, you know, and I've heard someone say this before, do you think we're kind of creating too many lawyers or pushing people down the legal route when actually we've got a bit of an oversupply? Or does it even itself out? Do people take different paths? Is it just because they're trying to get into those big legal firms? Why is it so competitive?
It's quite interesting because when I was in law school, it was sort of the main option. So throughout the, is it 2.5, 3 years I was there, I remember going to career fairs and it would just be the top six firms in all of New Zealand that would be promoting the graduate programs. And so there wasn't really an alternative pathway. I didn't want to go into the big firms. There's nothing against them because I think they do good training and there's good quality work. I just didn't want that pressure and I didn't want to work, you know, like you hear the horror stories about working 6 a.m. to midnight and 7 days a week and, you know, and I had some friends that did go into those firms and got burnt out. So what I wanted to do was to make a difference. I've always wanted to do that. So I carved a different journey for me. So after coming back from Australia, I got a job straight away. I worked as a junior barrister for a barrister up in Auckland who focused on criminal and immigration with some elements of employment law. And I was in court the first week I got my practicing certificate. So, and that's always, that was an interesting start. But yeah, and it's different training, but it's a different pathway. And I don't think it's the right one. It's just you, as a lawyer or a law graduate, you just need to find out, you know, what your values are, know what they are and stick to them and carve out the pathway that you want for yourself.
Yeah, that's a fair statement. I think certainly the ethical side of law and the human side of law, I think, has definitely become more apparent in the last few years, which is good to see, I think, for a lot of people. Okay, so you did your stint with the barrister in Auckland and then was MC next or...? Was there something in between?
No, so in between. So I did 3.5 years there. I took a 8-month break. It was probably signs of burnt out and just had enough and wanted a bit of a change. Did 4 months overseas. So this was back in June 2019. So we went to Europe, Central Asia, Western China, and then China, and then came back to New Zealand. And then at that stage, reconsidering options and whether or not we'll keep travelling. But then obviously the COVID pandemic hit. And mum and dad were in southern China in November when they had heard at the markets that there was something going up north and we didn't know what it was. And we decided to stay put. So I actually spent, my partner and I spent another 4 months in the Coromandel. So just beach life was great.
Hard life for some.
And then I realised that actually at that stage I needed to get a job and probably, yeah, the pandemic was sticking around. So I got a job down here in Christchurch, zoomed in and, yeah, it was good.
And that was working for another legal firm?
Yeah, a law firm down here.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. Mid-tier, yeah.
Cool. All right. And then at what point did you think, do you know what, I don't want the luxury of regular pay and regular hours and all the trappings of being an employee, decided to set up on your own? So was there a trigger moment that made you think, yep, I'm going to go and do it? Or was it something you fell into? You talk us through that.
I've always been interested in it, especially because I worked for a single barrister up in Auckland. And then I sort of got the understanding of how a practice would run and how, like, it's all stuff that you don't really get taught in university. And so when I came down here to Christchurch about 3 years ago now, or 3 and a bit years ago, the firm didn't actually have an immigration practice. So for me, it was a really good challenge because it meant that I got the chance of having regular income, but still got the flexibility of trying to build a practice from scratch when it wasn't a particular, it wasn't a specialty area that had been offered traditionally in terms of its surface practice areas, sorry, that the firm offered. And then I started. We came down on the set on the I think on the Friday, and then on the Saturday, Jacinda announced the four levels, and then I think we went lockdown on the Wednesday or Thursday, and then I started my job on that Monday. So effectively, new city, new firm, new practice, all during the pandemic. And what I found was because I hadn't relied, I had relied on the international market, but I hadn't relied on offshore work. All of my work previously had been onshore. So I managed to capitalize on that and just build my relationships remotely at this stage to work on previous clients that I helped before. And then from there, it just grew.
Okay, but it wasn't a eureka moment or a headbang moment. You were, you know what, I'm going to go out and set up on my own.
Probably last year, but May last year when I was like, I just had enough. I had enough that I wasn't, nothing against the firm, but I just realised, oh, actually, I can do this on my own. I managed to make my own salary and more. Why don't I do it myself and organise it myself?
And I remember when we spoke last week, you said, your family had some opinions on that move.
Yeah. So my parents came from a village in China, so they're pretty traditional Chinese, and they were, my dad was just like, "What do you mean? Oh, so are you busy? Like, do you have work?" And I'm like, "Yeah, no, I'm actually quite busy, Dad." I know it looks like I'm quite carefree and relaxed, but yeah, no, I'm pretty busy.
yeah. And I think that's just parents' prerogative, right? They're always going to come from a different generation to you. And it's interesting because I read something the other day that you bring your own children up, but you're bringing up them in a world which is probably a world that, let me rephrase that. So you're bringing up your children in a world that you grew up in, but no longer exists.
Mm.
So the kids, you know, that you're bringing up now, just their whole life and the whole society is different. So you have to kind of be a bit open and to let them find their own way. I think most parents will, right?
I think it'll be quite hard. I'm not a parent myself, but I think it'll be quite hard for parents now because it's like you're going through challenges that you never had gone through, and you're actually going through yourself, right? Yep. So how are you supposed to bring up children in that sort of environment, right?
But I agree 100%. But I think it's no different. I just think every generation has their own different challenges, and that's just life, right? Life evolves. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So I hear you 100%. Okay, so you're now in business, MC mm-hmm. Legal.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what your first two or three engagements were. What were they doing?
When I set up my practice, I got my practicing certificate on the day my practicing on my own account was approved. So that was quite quick from the Law Society. And that afternoon, I got my first engagement. And that was just, wow, I couldn't believe it. And it was to help an American client go through the partnership residence pathway. And looking at any risks, addressing it and advising him on that. So the partnership category has always been sort of the stuff that makes you feel good. I always love bringing couples together, especially for those that are based in New Zealand and offshore and trying to reunite them. And because of the last 3 years, it's been pretty incredibly difficult. So.
I feel like there's a romantic comedy for Netflix idea in there somewhere, right? You know. Wasn't there a Gerard Depardieu green card or something? Was that an 80s movie about immigration and visas?
I have to send me the link to it.
Retro. Okay, so it was a partnership visa. And I guess probably a good opportunity to ask what you actually do. So from my perspective, you know, immigration law, and obviously that will probably overlap into employment law as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two sides of it, right? So you've got the employers who are trying to find staff and bring staff into the country and play ball in the right way in terms of those immigration steps.
Yes.
And then you've got, on the other side of things, you've got the people who are, you know, trying to either get those jobs or move countries. And and someone like myself who's actually done that, you know, albeit 9 years ago, is an interesting process to go through. So it's the first time you help both of those parties, and so sometimes it'll be companies coming to you, sometimes it will be individuals. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's fair. probably about 50-50 at my current work stage. So my second client was quite a big client for a business or organisation up in Auckland, and they needed basically their right-hand man, their right-hand woman for their immigration matters. So I work closely with the people and culture team and look at, first I initially looked at reviewing all the current processes and then making recommendations. Then it was about getting them accredited. And then also making sure they've got the job checks, which is, you know, the roles that they have available or underway and approved, so that they could be ready for their recruitment for this year.
Okay, that's perfect. So let's break this down then. So first things first, if we look at a company who's looking to employ people from overseas, my understanding is there's two paths. You either become an accredited employer, which we'll talk about in a moment, or you can go down the other route, which is, you're not an accredited employer, but you have to show you've tried to recruit local people and, you know, you've tried traditional paths. Is that correct?
Mostly. So the first pathway is the accredited employer, and that will become likely compulsory next year. The second pathway is using what other visa options there are to try and supplement your current workforce. So, for example, we talked about the agri sector just before. I always make a recommendation to have working holiday visa holders, especially now because I think they've increased the numbers as well because they're trying to get people over here. They get visas for, you know, 1 to 3 years. So if they're here, then on an open work visa, they can start away.
So they're essentially applying off their own back rather than being any connection with the employer.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the accredited employer thing I thought was interesting because the business that brought me over, which no longer exists anymore, we've since been bought out by Capgemini, a couple of steps, but they were an accredited employer at the time and, you know, employing technical and IT people from overseas was quite tricky, but it just appeared very quickly when I was going through the immigration process that it was a lot more streamlined. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, so I'm assuming probably about 9 years ago you came over on the talent accredited employer pathway,
skills,
was it?
Skills visa.
Skills visa, yeah. So, so it would have been probably an average of about, if you earned over 55,000, worked for an employer for 2 years, then you can apply for residency.
That's the one.
Is that the one? Yeah, I thought so because I actually helped an IT specialist on that one ever before. So.
Yeah. Worked, I think it was called work to residency, but it was based on your skills, right?
But
because they were an accredited employer, it meant that it definitely streamlined. You didn't have to provide as much information as part of that application.
Yeah, absolutely. So the immigration at that stage would have knowing what the business was all about, making sure that they were financially viable, had good workplace policies, et cetera, all the good stuff.
Okay.
And then when you came to apply for the visa, it would have been straightforward because all you needed to show was your qualification.
Yeah. I had a lot of those plastic envelopes, you know, an A4 bits of paper and post-it notes, and I was quite organised. But yeah, it was relatively straightforward once you got your paperwork organised. But just on the point about being an accredited employer, so this comes up quite a lot in conversations around barbecues and fires, et cetera, in New Zealand. But to become an accredited employer, what are the key kind of criteria, key bits of criteria that you need to adhere to?
So it's a bit, so the current new system is very different to the talent accredited employer pathway.
Yeah, so modern day.
Modern day. So it's not as much paperwork. So it's all declaration based. So firstly, that the business is in a sound financial situation. So positive cash flow, hasn't made a loss in the last couple of years. Like there's a few elements.
Is there any minimum turnover or?
No minimum turnover.
Okay.
But it has to be in a financial situation where it can actually employ people.
Yeah. And how do you do that if you're a relatively new business?
I think it's declaration based, so you don't actually have to provide evidence of it. But any declarations you make has to be truthful.
Okay.
So, for example, if it's a new business, I think if it's only been registered for 12 months, it'll be a bit of, you know, there might be some backwards and forwards communications with INZ.
Yeah.
But if you're an established business, it should be quite straightforward.
Okay. You become an accredited employer, fill out some paperwork, provide some information. Mm-hmm. Any fees involved?
Yes, actually, that's a very good question. Can I pause that? So, yeah, so there's three different types of accreditation. So standard accreditation, this is the INZ application fee, 740. High volume, which is probably quite common, that's more than five workers on the accredited employer work visa, that's 1,200, just over 1,200. And then there's also the triangular arrangement. So if you're a labour hire business, and that's, I think that's over 3,000. So it's quite a lot in terms of the actual
And that's per annum? Per applicant?
Per accreditation.
Okay.
So another key point now is that if businesses are not accredited and they want to be, I suggest filing an accreditation before the 4th of July because the first accreditation's been extended. So if you file before the 4th of July, you get 24 months of accreditation. Anything filed on the 5th, say, you only get 12 months.
Okay.
So huge benefits for businesses. I'm trying to encourage a lot just do it now because, yeah. Wow.
And I'm sure there's someone we know that could help them out if they need any help, right?
Hopefully.
Okay. So that's how you become an accredited employer. And then I would imagine it's then per applicant. So there's a process that you'd have to go through for each applicant or each role that you're trying to fill. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's right. So that's part of the second stage process. So also employer-led. So it's called a job check application. So say, for example, if you're a dairy farmer and you want to hire some herd managers and you think, oh, it's a big commercial enterprise, you want maybe three or two herd managers, you've got to do the job check. What I tell my employer clients is that you should double the numbers. So, for example, if you've only got one herd manager, you're only looking at recruiting one herd manager, I just put in two. Simply because in that 6 months, the business might change. But you don't have to use it, but it's still valid for 6 months. So if you see another really good overseas candidate that's in the country and you say, great, they've got the right qualifications, I want to get this guy on board as well, you've actually got a really streamlined process and you can invite them to apply for the work visa.
Yeah, good advice. Okay, so they have to fill out certain checks. And one thing I hear quite a lot is red tape and bureaucracy, and it's hard to do that. You hear that from a lot from employers about Immigration NZ. But coming from the UK, I actually thought the process was pretty slick, you know, compared to UK bureaucracy and red tape, etc. But I mean, have you got any kind of opinions or any views on how, you know, the slickness or the bureaucracy is compared to other countries?
I probably agree with you, Lee. I do think New Zealand is a lot better than other countries. I remember the very first visa I applied for was a visa to go to Russia. And my God, the paperwork that was involved. And I got declined the first time, actually. So I think at least with Immigration New Zealand, you always get a chance. And you can, they've got systems in place now. I mean, it's the best system we've got. So, I mean, it's the system we've got, so I've got to work with the system, right?
Yeah.
So you can escalate it. Especially from an employer's perspective. So if I help my clients and I know that they need that worker straight away, I would escalate it through the chain of command. Yeah.
Okay. So that the part of being an accredited employer, it's fill out the information, give the information you need, and then what's the ongoing obligations at that point then? So is there anything as an employer that you have to constantly be doing, or any checks or paperwork that you have to fill out, you know, on an ongoing basis as an accredited employer?
They don't have a list of things that you need, but you just need to make sure that you meet the minimum employment immigration standards and that if there's any changes in your management, so for a bigger organisation, if like key people in the HR team or any sort of ones that make hiring decisions, that needs to be updated to INZ within 10 working days. So there's sort of those kind of deadlines. Otherwise, it's just ensuring that if you've got anyone on board, they've been sent, especially on the accredited employer work visa, they've been sent relevant information. So how to settle into New Zealand, which is really good, I think. Something that I find that some employers agree and disagree with. But I think overall it is useful information, especially for someone that's moving to a country for the first time.
Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. So I know there's been some announcements this morning and in recent days around different changes that are being made to skills visas and visas, etc. But one thing I thought would be really useful is just to go through what the key visas are. And key visas are optional. Now, I know there's heaps of sub visas and subclasses that you can, so we don't want to go down that route. But if we can just look at the typical types of visas that are available for both the employees and the employers. So just talk us through what those key ones are.
So for the employer's perspective, there's only really, I guess I'll broadly say three types. So you've got the working holiday visa holders, those on a post-study work visa. So they're open work visa, someone that's completed a bachelor's degree or higher, or maybe level 7 or higher degree in New Zealand, and they've got an open visa. So those two visa types, you can hire them straight away. Because they've got open work conditions. With the working holiday visas, there might be a restriction on the type of employment they can have. So maybe casual, or they can't be given permanent employment. So you just got to check those conditions.
And did I read somewhere that you can't work for somewhere more than 3 months at a given time? Was that still the case?
Yeah, so that's certain types. I guess it depends on where the person's from. So some have that condition, some don't.
So if I'm running a hospital business, a bar chain, and I want to bring someone over who's, you know, doing their reverse OE, as I call it, you know, come over here instead of us going over there. But they come over here and they want a bit of work, you know, to fund their travels, etc. They can do that, but for no more than 3 months. Is that in any one place? Is that correct?
Yeah. So that would be, just check the visa conditions. So okay. It actually stipulates that.
Right.
So I would recommend on that case. Casual contracts.
Nothing permanent.
Yeah.
And then can they get around it if they go and, you know, work for one of the other brands within the chain, or is that a bit of a no-no?
Well, I think if it's the parent company and it's all on the company's record, it might be a bit of a no-no.
Right. I know there's going to be people listening and thinking, is that a good question?
And I've seen immigration check up on it.
Yeah.
So it would be a little bit cautious on that. Yeah.
That's fair. Okay. And so that working holiday visa is generally what? Tends to be some of the younger people that are coming over here to travel and saying they can work and fund their travels on their way. So that's the working holiday visa.
Mm-hmm.
That lasts longer than a year, is that correct?
12 months, yeah. Or some have been extended to 24 months. Yeah, so.
Cool. All right. Fantastic. And hopefully we're starting to see a bit more of those being issued, because obviously that tends to be what fuels hospo and tourism, you know, certainly helps those industries out. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, no, that's fair. I think INZ made an announcement. I can't remember the exact numbers, but they've actually either doubled or definitely increased more slots. But it's just a matter of uptake, really, from the other end, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so working holiday visa. Mm-hmm. What's the next one?
So I said the post-study open work visa. So that's when someone's come over as an international student, did a relevant qualification, usually now it has to be a bachelor's degree or higher, and they get issued a 1 year, 2 year, or now 3 year open work visa. So there's no conditions with that.
So using that scenario, let's just say my niece or nephew does their degree in the UK, decide they just want to come and live over here for a little while, that's all they need?
So if they studied in the UK, they won't be eligible for that visa.
They won't.
Yeah, no, they have to study in New Zealand.
Oh, sorry, I misunderstand. Okay, so someone who's come over as an international student, got their degree or their master's in New Zealand, and then they say, right, okay, well, I want to build a life here and live here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's when they can build up their work experience.
Yeah, okay.
And they can work in any industry.
Yeah.
But I usually recommend for someone that's, you know, if they've got a architecture degree, then to obviously work as an architect or graduate.
Yeah, don't use it in an industry that might not get as much benefit.
Yeah, I mean, it was a few years ago when they had a lot of people graduate with the business diploma, so it would just be just any industry getting experience.
So I suppose that from an employer's perspective, though, you're probably looking at that channel on the basis that you've got some of the next brighter, not always younger, but next brighter things coming through, and you're getting someone who's obviously academic and, you know, is going to be an asset to an organisation, and maybe they find their own pathway, but that essentially it's tapping into that emerging talent pool. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, no, that's a fair statement, yeah. Okay, and they're likely to stay with, you know, you as an employer,
Cool. So that's a good one to know about.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's the next one?
I'll say the accredited employer work visa. So that's the biggest one at the moment.
This one I came over on?
Different.
Different. Okay.
Yeah, different. Oh. It's very confusing. when they made the name change, I thought, oh no, there's going to be a lot of confusion.
You're doing a very good job explaining, by the way.
Yeah, it's highly technical. I try to make it as simple and easy to understand as possible.
So let's read it. Accredited employer visa.
Yes.
So what's that?
So that's the one we just talked about earlier. So if you're an employer, you have to be accredited, and then you have to pass the job checks at the second stage. And then after that, you can invite an overseas candidate or a candidate in New Zealand to apply for the accredited employer work visa.
So what would be an example of a business that uses that?
All sorts. I think at the moment, after June 1st, with calving season, I've got a lot of farmers. Started contacting me back in May saying that, oh no, we need these workers in for the busy period ahead. Yeah. So they are keen to, you know, if they've got standard accreditation, so that's up to 5 accredited employer work visa holders working for you, getting those job checks underway. Yeah. So whether that be dairy assistant or herd managers or whichever.
So some of those meat packers or those other primary industries where bring over seasonal workers, and is it that they'd use it for?
Yeah, so that would be a little bit different. So there's some other categories for the, I think especially the meat processing, there might be, I have to check into that actually, because I think there are actual industry specific numbers. Right.
Yeah, there is.
With the meat processing workers.
Which are very targeted at a very specific industry, and that's what you use for those, right?
Yes. And there's a limited number.
So would a good example on that accredited employer, would a labour hire business be an example of that? So I run a labour hire business. Mm-hmm. We've got demand for 50 carpenters or electricians or whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. And I want to bring over someone, you know, for a tippy or, you know, for a carpenter's job. And essentially that's maybe the visa. And I'm an accredited employer. So do these checks, bring them over, and that's the accredited employer visa.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, understood. Okay, what else?
There's also it's not really a new one, but it used to be the partnership work visa types. So there's 2 types under the partnership. So those are partners of a New Zealander. So they've got open work conditions. So they can work for any business straight away, or they can set up their own business, whichever. The others is being a partner of a work visa holder. So there's been a few changes in that particular category. So if you are an accredited employer, you can still hire someone that's on the partnership, and you don't have to provide a job check for them, but you just have to provide a job offer to show that you are an accredited employer.
Okay, and that's probably for people that maybe come over with their partner and you know, looking to get into work themselves and get some employment, gainful employment themselves. Okay, understood. And then any others?
Those are probably the main types at the moment. I won't go through the student visas. Yeah. So some students can work for you up to 20 hours a week.
Yeah. Now, did I misunderstand? Did I mishear? You said that becoming an accredited employer is going to become compulsory. Is that right?
Yeah. So I think I don't know if there's an exact date yet on the cards, but yeah. So there was an indication by government saying that it will become compulsory next year.
So any business, regardless of numbers, volume, even if you want to hire one person, you've got to become an accredited employer, do the checks, get through that, and then you can go and employ people.
Yeah. So I had a really interesting question probably a few months ago saying that if I've only historically relied on working holiday visas, do I still need to be accredited? Because it's quite a lot of expense up front, right? With that new change, yes, it doesn't matter what visa type you hire, you still got to be accredited.
Okay. So that's the stuff that kind of probably the employer route in terms of getting into New Zealand. So presumably there's then stuff that you can do off your own back. So there's the skills visas and so forth. So the stuff that if I make the decision to move to New Zealand, haven't necessarily found employment, don't necessarily know what I want to do, but is there other visa classes that you can then do off your own back?
Yeah, so historically I've had, you know, before and now after the COVID pandemic, I've got a few people that have come over on visitor visas. So just exploring the country, you know, the genuine intention was to be a visitor, so explore the South Island, say, so beautiful here. And then they realise, oh, cool, love to be able to bring my family here. What can I do? What are my options, right? So it really depends on what kind of background you have. So if you are, you know, working, you've got whatever specialist skill set you have, so engineering, doctor, being a, you know, healthcare professional, teachers, you know, those professional occupations, you've pretty much got a pathway there because of the skill set that you can offer. But it really depends on where you're from as well. but there is the green list. So it's called the work to residence or the straight to residence pathway. So that was quite a game changer, especially for those, because we're trying to fill, for example, teachers. We're really trying to fill a huge shortage, especially in the next couple of years. Yeah. It's been all over the news.
And it doesn't help the Victorian government advertise on the radio to try and poach teachers to go over there, right?
Yeah, I just heard it yesterday, actually. Is it early childhood teachers? Yeah. I thought, oh, wow.
Gloves are off.
Yeah, I know. And I think, you know, I heard the other day from another lawyer, they said, you know, if someone switched over being a professional, you get a 30% increase in wages, yeah, just like that.
So that brain drain's definitely a thing at the moment. Yeah. Okay. So as an individual, you have different options available to you. The skills is obviously the main thing that's going to get you into the country, right? If you're a professional and have worked in your trade 5 years, I think between three to five years, I think.
Yeah, 3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years. Yeah. And then it's really a case of providing references and, you know, the necessary information to back that up. And I can remember when I came over, because I'd worked for a consultancy that was only three people, it was quite hard to, and I was the owner of the business.
Oh, no.
What have you been doing? Have you got any references? But it was quite interesting because the firm were an accredited employer.
Mm.
We just had to confirm that we've been trading, you know, and I think we had one client reference maybe, and it was a lot more streamlined. So, but yeah, that skills visa was, you know, that would have been an option as well. Okay. So different options available for employers, different options available for individuals looking to come to NZ. What were some of the changes that were made this morning or in the last few days?
Probably this morning, actually. I think we were just talking about it just before.
We were.
Yeah, so it's the changes to the skill migrant category. So that's probably, for those listeners, it's the one that had initially 160 points and then 180. And if you've got a job offer and it's a skilled job offer and you've got the right qualifications, et cetera, and you have enough points, you can apply first for an expression of interest to say that you've got X amount of points and you qualify. And then once you're selected, you are invited to apply. So that's the skilled pathway that you mentioned earlier.
What are the big changes that they've made there then?
So they've actually they've just announced it, but they're going to change the points system. So instead of the 180, which is what everyone's used to now, or 160 before, they're going to narrow it down to 6 points. So it's based on what it was originally before, so a skilled job offer or be in employment. So it has
And that's a lot of points, right, if you've got an offer of employment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, that's half your application, yeah, right? Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you don't have an offer, there's no point considering it. Yeah.
Yeah. So just for the listeners' benefit, I mean, I haven't been through this process myself. You have to reach a certain amount of points and you get different amounts of brownie points for different things. So speaking English to a decent level, coming from East London, some of my family might disagree with that. But speaking English at a certain level, having gained, employment in a certain industry, professional qualifications, degree, you know, and all of these points add up to the minimum criteria, right? Mm-hmm. So you're looking for, what I'm hearing, like you're saying, is they've reduced the amount of points that you need to get in on that visa, or they've just reclassified some of those things?
They've reclassified is probably a better way to put it. So instead of 180, it's just 6 points. So you get, say, for example, you've got a skilled job offer. So skilled job offer, that's always been the question, because employers say, what does it mean by skilled, right? Because they know their roles and they believe it's skilled. But what INZ use is called the ANSCO, so the Australian New Zealand Standard Classification of Occupations.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mouthful.
Yep.
ANSCO is way easier. So they classify all jobs into 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. 1 to 3 being higher skilled, 4 and 5 being lower skilled. So for those professional occupations we just mentioned earlier, so doctors, teachers, nurses, all IT specialists, they'll probably be 1 to 3. And then 4 and 5 would be more sort of like the labour sort of roles, right?
Yeah, skilled trades.
Yes, skilled trades. So if you're offered a position that's 1 to 3, you have to get you have to be offered at least the median wage, which is now $29.66. Or if you're in a skill base, which is 4 and 5, you have to be 1.5 times that
wage. Do you think those wages are going to go up? Because I've always looked at those. And having been someone who's been trying to employ and obviously been through the other side of things. But I've always looked at it and gone, that's pretty low. You know, the wages that you've got to, you know, it should be higher.
I think it depends on the role, right? It depends on the industry. I think especially for those hospitality employers out there, I mean, how can you afford to pay someone $30 an hour?
Yeah.
You know, especially with the cost of everything, ingredients, et cetera. So, I mean, but then I guess if you're, say, a teacher, or I guess in the public system, it'll be obviously not enough, but
it sounds like you've got your parents behind you and mentioning the cost of those, those hospo workers. But no, I hear you in the role. I suppose in IT and certainly in technology roles, I suppose we've been quite fortunate because they're pretty well paid in most of the time. Okay. All right. So lots of different options. Mm-hmm. There's one final question I'm going to ask you is the family route. So obviously, when you decide to go overseas and you build a brave new life, you leave family behind. So I can remember my mum telling me on her deathbed, she passed away 3 years ago, that I was like a pirate and was stealing her grandchildren away from her. So I was like, okay, mum, let's not leave anything unsaid. But obviously a dagger to the heart. But the reality is you do leave family behind. And my dad, who isn't with us either, but at one stage he's like, it's all right, son, I'm coming out there. It's like, oh God, what's going on? But he was pretty adamant that he was going to come out. And when I did a bit of research, it was because of his ill health, and he was a driver for HGV driver for class 3 or 4, I think they call it over here. So he wouldn't have had the skills. He would have failed on health grounds. So family visas, has that got better? Is it a bit more open there? And do you see a lot of people struggling to try and bring family over? Because it is hard, you know, especially if your family want to come with you.
I think, the parents is a difficult one. There's been a few changes in that particular category, and I really feel for the ones that have come here and then got residency, and now they're just like, okay, great, I've got my aging parents back at home, want to bring them over. The most common one would be a visitor visa, 3 years to 5 years, each visit being about 6 months each time, or 3 to 6 months, I say. That's the easiest, but you still don't have that element of permanency. So you don't have residency. You don't have the rights of a resident or permanent resident visa holder in New Zealand. But it gives a chance for the parents to come and visit when they're still, able to. Another one is the parent category. That was shut in 2016.
Yeah.
And then it got reopened in February 2020. Yeah. And then it got shut that week.
And that's where you basically say, I'm going to sponsor, I'm going to look after them, I'm going to pay for them, they won't be a drain on the health system.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. So as the adult child, you can sponsor them. At the time, I think it was like, you know, it got so much uptake that's why they shut it. So the original policy was you only, as a single person, you could earn, I think it was $60,000, and then combined, husband and wife, $90,000. But that changed. And then I think it was like 2 times the median wage, and it was so unachievable. And I remember one situation where I had 2 specialist doctors and they could only support 3 out of 4 parents. I mean, that's heartbreaking. How would you choose?
Sorry, mum.
Didn't make the cut.
No, didn't make the cut. Should have got better Christmas presents.
I mean, if 2 highly qualified professionals couldn't afford to support 4, I mean.
Yeah, and I can remember, I think my dad sent me the link to that, and I think I was having a bit of a panic attack at that point. I said, oh God, he's going to come live around the corner for me.
Yeah.
Not that I wouldn't have wanted that, of course.
No.
Okay, all right. So family visas, a few changes. And as you say, it's been bit up and down in terms of trying to go down that route for visas. Okay, all right. So really good understanding of all the different options available. Now, you mentioned that you do it for purpose and you do it for do something good for. So what's been some of the memorable cases you've been involved in where it's just a real good feel good story and a good outcome?
I've got a few.
what's the most memorable one?
Most memorable, I think maybe the very feel good one, most recent one, would be an Immigration Protection Tribunal case. Father was declined a work visa because of his not meeting with some of the conditions. And then it would impact his wife and son, who had already been settled in New Zealand, had been settled in New Zealand for, oh, I think 15 years. So the whole family would have to go back home. And the son was an achiever. You know, he'd got all the awards, you know, really smart, bright kid. And we had to file a tribunal appeal. And it was on humanitarian grounds. And they got it approved. And I actually asked, because they were on a work visa, I actually, as part of the appeal, I actually asked for them to be granted residency straight away. And they won that. And the whole family got to stay. So that was, yeah, I met them and just, yeah, it was breakdown. A few tears shared, a few laughters and, yeah, all sorts and whatnot. At the same time, I had another man, he was an individual, but he had a New Zealand family here, been in the country about 10 years, but then was some issues with providing false and misleading information. And I actually didn't think that there was a strong case, because in terms of our immigration system, trust and honesty and integrity is the biggest thing. So if there has been any element of fraud or misleading information, immigration go hard at it, and you need to justify or explain or whatever, outline the circumstances, right? So I didn't think that he would, you know, would be successful. But then anyone that engages me, well, you know, they know that I would back them, right? I would do my best out of my ability to do to make sure that their case has been best foot forward, really. But yeah, so he got his residency allowed, and I think he'll probably be on the pathway to permanent residency now. So that was a really good one when I called him, because if he were to go back to his home country, there were a whole lot of repercussions there.
For like refugee status, or, you know, for that kind of thing? Or?
No, just because it was from a Muslim country.
Okay.
So there were, yeah, so that sort of background. And so there was a fear that maybe there might be some repercussions for him in terms of his personal safety and whatnot. And it wasn't a refugee case at all. But yeah, when I called him, because I wasn't in the same city at the time, I just called him straight away, and he just had to have a few moments of silence. And yeah, he was pretty pleased with that one. Yeah, so a few heartwarmers, especially with those individuals and their families being reunited. I've got so many, but yeah. I've only got time for a couple.
So what are Immigration NZ like to deal with, though? So, because presumably you're often to be broker a lot of the time in terms of, you know, the facts are presented from the applicant, and obviously Immigration NZ will probably have their view on things, and, you know, they're obviously ticking a lot of boxes, let's be honest about it, but obviously they have to have certain rules, which I completely understand. But, you know, do they provide that kind of human factor? I mean, you're able to have a conversation, have face-to-face meetings, or is it all done very matter-of-fact and via portals and via emails?
It really depends on who you get. But in the last, probably the whole time I've been practicing in immigration, I've dealt with so many different types of immigration officers. It's just the nature of the system. It's a high turnover. But then there are a few regulars that I've dealt with, and they're the same people, and they remain in immigration for the period of time I've been practicing. But I always, I always try to give them a call. Probably about 80 to 90% of the time they answer. But otherwise I deal with them through email.
Do you have to be sort of nominated by the individual to say, yeah, I'm okay to speak about my case with this person? Do they have to kind of sign a disclaimer, or, you know, or just at least phone them up to say I'm okay with this?
So they just have to give me authority. Yeah, I don't need to sign. I mean, I always get a letter signed anyway, but I just, you know, once the individual or employer, so if it's a business, then they give me the authority to act on the business behalf, right? So then I just give them a call and just sound it out. So some situations where I haven't lodged anything, and it's all anonymous, and I sound out the situation, get a feel for the case officer, especially if it's ones that don't meet the tick box exercise, and then I just say, look, this is the kind of the overview, what are your thoughts, how do we get it, you know, how do we make sure that it's achievable, or if it isn't, then, you know.
Yeah, because once again, I think they get a bit of a bad rep, you know, in terms of bureaucracy and red tape, but most of the time I think, you know, I said 9 times out of 10, I think the dealings I've had that there's always a human at the end of a phone, and they explain things. The only thing they haven't explained is why my citizenship application's taken 15 months so far. might be the character, right? But, yeah. I guess all they can say there is they're working for a backlog, but I think that's the COVID. The consequence of COVID, and they got that backlog and they was out of action for a certain period of time. So I think there's ploughing through that backlog and they'll get there eventually.
Yeah, and it's not just New Zealand, it's around the world, you know. I think it was Canada was also similar. It's about 18 months.
So on that note, I mean, what's the average, and I know you're going to say it depends on the visa, but what's the kind of average turnaround time for someone who's, you know, to process an accredited visa? Is that pretty straightforward?
Do you mean from the accreditation perspective? Or yeah, you mean
so
the
let's
work
just
visa?
Say I'm an accredited employer. Mm-hmm. I'm going to employ someone on that accredited visa that mm-hmm. we spoke about. So how long am I looking at before I can, to get that person in the country and they can start work if I apply today?
If that person applies today, I would say a minimum of a month. Okay. Minimum. And that's if they've got all the paperwork underway. It can be faster. It depends on where that person, what the skill set is for that person. Yeah. Yep.
So it's in people's interest to become accredited, really, and to get a bit of a head start on things.
Especially now, because I think we've got about just over two weeks left before the 4th of July deadline. So I'm already seeing now there's going to be a huge influx of employers wanting to get accredited because they could save the extra 12 months.
Yeah.
But then we know that July would be a huge processing month for immigration.
Yeah.
So that's going to cause delay because there's a lot more businesses trying to get accredited before the 4th of July deadline, you see. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So because there's an increase of applications, that's where we're going.
So, Michelle, you're obviously doing pretty well. Sounds like you're busy. What's the main reason people are coming to you?
Or
main reasons, should I say?
I think my responsiveness, usually it's quite funny because you think lawyers are really good communicators and most of them are, but it's just being able to just, I found that just doing the basics. If someone emails me, I always acknowledge the email within 24 hours, if not 12. If I can't attend to it straight away, then I actually say, look, I'll give you a time frame. I'm upfront with my fees. Where possible, I always give a fees estimate, simply because I think that the traditional model of an hourly rate, I don't think it's going to work in this current stone age.
Lawyers aren't going to be very happy with you.
Well, in terms of my work, I'm able to to give an estimate. And just actually just getting the results. I think if not getting the results, at least providing a risk assessment on whether or not they'll be successful.
And I think that, it's probably, testament to kind of the way you work and, it says a lot about the way you work as well. But is there some common scenarios that they come to you, so they've got stuck here or they've reached an impasse here or, they're just a bit overwhelmed or, is it all of the above? What's the primary, when they're saying to you, okay, I need some help with a student visa, a temporary visa, a family visa, or my case has been declined, or, is there an atypical reason that they're engaging you?
An atypical, okay. So I think the last month I've had a lot of the 2021 residencies they're probably about 85% processed at the moment, so there's 165,000 residencies being issued. Mostly there, but the last we're on the last stretch, right? But I've been seeing a lot of people that might have like a criminal offending or a criminal conviction or traffic conviction, even like careless driving causing injury, and then that's caused a character concern for their residency. So I saw a huge influx of that kind of work coming through. And because of my criminal background, I'm able to advise quite adequately on that. Well, I think I can. And then another one is probably employers. So there's so much information available on Google, on the immigration website. And the traditional model of what they thought they knew had changed so much in the last 3 years that some of the knowledge is right, but some of the policies might have changed. So they might come to me and just say, help. Can you just do it for me? Look after it for me? And that's where I step in. And I just, like I said earlier, am their right-handed woman and just sort of manage it all for them.
Yeah. Is there any common mistakes you're seeing people make in when it comes to immigration and visas, et cetera?
Probably from the employer's perspective, it's that labour market testing. So some roles would have to be advertised and not having everything on the advert. So, for example, the minimum and maximum range on the role, a lot of employers don't want to advertise that rate. But actually, in terms of immigration's eyes, for it to be compliant and for it to tick the box, you still need that. And then obviously offering the minimum hours, so it has to be a minimum of 30 hours per week contract. Yeah.
And we were talking about that last week, right?
Yeah.
Because there were some stories that came out of businesses down in Queenstown that that weren't giving the people on those visas the required hours that was in their contract. So 30 hours minimum would have been the stipulation, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And they weren't getting that. They was getting 20. My belief in that is a lot of that was probably done unknowingly. They probably wasn't aware that they had to give that many hours, or, you know, maybe the contract was raised by someone else, or maybe, you know, one of their admin people, and maybe they didn't realise that they weren't on the roster. And so I think probably that might be done unwittingly, but nonetheless, they're still in breach of visa, like you mentioned.
Yeah, and so if that person's in breach of their visa, that might cause a repercussion for the employers at their accreditation renewal. Yeah, so it's really good to do an audit of what your policies are or processes, and also the employment documents.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So finally, if we look at New Zealand, that has traditionally been a nation of immigrants, you know, myself included, you know, from different paths and different places around the world. I was at a conference about 3 months ago where a journalist spoke, and he mentioned that New Zealand really should be planning to be a population of 16 million. And we'll do that through a combination of immigration, but also, you know, training and nurturing and keeping the people, you know, who shouldn't be going overseas. But immigration is going to be a big part of that if we do want to become one of the Asia-Pac superpowers. Our population's got to go up. So have you got any kind of strong opinions on what the future of immigration is for the next sort of 4 or 5 years for New Zealand?
That's a really, really interesting question. I think at the current, where the immigration policy is heading is to attract those high-skilled workers right at the stage, which is why there's the change of the skilled migrant, the highs, you know, the green list that we mentioned earlier. But I think it's going to be really, really difficult for those that want to come here and just work, you know, labourers or, you know, like I talked about, dairy assistants and stuff. And they're actually the ones that keep the business, like the economy, like humming along, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you don't have those workers that might not have the specialist skill set or qualifications, then how would business keep going?
Yeah.
Because Kiwis are probably not wanting to do those work.
No, they're not. And I think Bernard Hickey hit the nail on the head. He was the guy who I heard speaking. But he mentioned that the challenge we've got is that we're losing those highly paid, highly skilled doctors, nurses, scientists, you know, IT, technology people, and replacing them with lower skilled, lower paid you know, immigrants to do more primary industry work, like dairy work and tourism. And so obviously that's going to have an impact on taxes and revenue as well, right?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
It'd just be interesting to see if anyone's got any, if you've got any opinions on that, whether you actually feel that that's going to go up or down, or whether things will correct themselves in a few years, or whether we'll get back to probably a nice blend of the two eventually, which I think personally will happen in 3 or 4 years' time.
Yeah, I just don't want it to be too late, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, is that if, you know, like we just talked about earlier, Victoria offering the the pay increase and getting teachers over, we're already at a crisis of having no teachers. So what will we do? What would the education system be?
Yeah.
So,
I actually think it's impacting the education system in New Zealand as well. You know, two kids are in that system. I think you only have to look at the options available in different schools. And yeah, it must be really hard to be in a principal or in a board of governors of trying to find these people, because they won't be there in 3 years' time potentially.
Yeah,
could be overseas.
I mean, like I was just talking to a neighbour earlier today, but they've got kids in high school and they've had, I think, 2 teachers only day or something. They've just, had 1 day last week at school. Yeah. I mean, their child's, and you know, it's a critical stage, especially in high school when you're preparing for university.
Yeah. Yeah, and interesting, in the UK, they've in the NHS, I don't know if you saw this, they have basically come out with this scheme where they're saying, well, you don't no longer have to have a degree, where you can do vocational training. So, and this isn't for the surgeon roles, but you know, it's like in the UK, they're out with their pitchforks, oh, we're not going to have any, you know, unskilled workers. I think what they're saying is for some of those more support roles, what's stopping someone getting 6-7 years of work experience to become a, you know, anaesthetist, maybe not anaesthetist, but, you know, one of those roles that isn't brain surgeons, essentially. You know? And I actually didn't think it was a bad idea. You know, you look at France and Spain and some of those European countries, that vocational routes they've always done. But and I actually don't think it'd be a bad idea in New Zealand either to go down that route. But because not everyone's academic, not everyone wants to go and go to uni. They actually want to start work and gain skills that way. So yeah, it'd be interesting times. Okay, all right. So as we come to the interview, as we come to the end of the interview, I want to ask you a question I ask everyone.
Okay.
If you could go back and give 21-year-old you some advice, what would that be?
21-year-old me. I think at 21 I was just preparing to go travel by myself. So it's a very good question. Don't let your self-limiting beliefs hold you back for me. I think I had a lot of, maybe it's also being female and being Asian, but maybe just don't let any of the sort of, you've got the voices in your head saying, oh, can you do it? Or are you good enough? Or that kind of stuff. But just make sure that you kind of dial that down a bit and just get on with it. Be open to opportunities. You don't know when they come. I think, for example, meeting you last week, Lee, if I hadn't, struck a conversation with you, we wouldn't have led to the podcast today.
100%.
Yeah, so but don't know when the opportunities will come, but if they do, just embrace it. Three is, I think you probably have heard of the phrase tall poppy syndrome. So there's always going to be people out there that will probably try and hold you back or try and put doubts in your thinking or whatever resistance there is. But just if you've got, just remain true to yourself. You've got your values, got your skill set. Just make sure that you just get on with it, really, and don't let those people stop you.
Nice. Okay. So I would imagine there'd be a lot of people listening to this and going, she knows that stuff. We really need to have someone like that in our network and someone we could engage. So what's the best way for people to check you out and get hold of you if they want to grab your services?
Feel free to just go onto my website. It's got a list of all the services I offer by for employers and individuals. Yeah. That's www.mclegal.nz. And then all my contact details are there. So you can feel free to give me a call or email. If I can't answer straight away, I'll definitely answer within 12 hours.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. Michelle, been fantastic speaking to you. Really appreciate you making the time to come in and speak to you about fascinating subject for me personally.
Yeah.
So yeah, loved it. And I'm sure we'd like to get you back on the show again at some point in the future as well.
Thank you, Lee. That was really good to talk to you through the immigration system.
Okay.
It's awesome.
Have a good week.
Cheers. Thank you.
Bye. Once again, another fascinating episode. Really enjoyed that one. A little bit different from the ones we've had to date. And I thought it was interesting getting an expert in to talk about immigration and how that affects so many of our businesses, and also the options that are available for both the businesses and for the individuals. It's obviously clear that Michelle's got a huge passion for helping people and also immigration law as well. So as I said at the start of the show, if you haven't done so already, it would be really helpful to rate the show. You can do that on Spotify or Apple by going to the show, scrolling down to the bottom, or click on the three dots and clicking rate show, and that will help me out immensely. In the meantime, have a good week.